So if you would just begin by introducing yourself, literally say, my name is Peter Sandman and I do X, Y, and Z.
My name is Peter Sandman, and I'm a specialist in something called risk communication, which basically means three things. When something is dangerous and people are ignoring it, I get hired to try to figure out how to scare them, to get them to take it more seriously. When something isn't dangerous and people are freaking out, I get hired to calm them down. And when something is dangerous and people are wisely freaking out, I get hired to help guide them through it.
All right. So there are the false dangers, the overhyped dangers, the underappreciated dangers, and the properly equilibrated dangers. Is that a word? Equilibrated?
Equilibrated, probably. I think.
Equilibrated. Thank you. The properly equilibrated dangers. In which case provides you the most employment?
Well, I intentionally try to divide my time about equally, scaring people doesn't pay nearly as well as reassuring people. So that even though I divide my time equally, my work with clients who are worried that the public is unduly freaking out subsidizes my work with clients that are trying to alert people to real risks.
I see. And just describe for me, I'll take as much as you want to tell me whether you want to name specific clients or not. I'd love it if you did. But also I'm just curious as to are you usually brought in after something dramatic happens or fails to happen, or are you more typically on retainer? How does it work?
It can be either. I have clients that have me on retainer. I have more clients that don't have me on retainer but have me in their contact list, what we used to call their Rolodex, and call me when an issue arises. But I also do a lot of work with clients that is essentially training for possible serious risks that they have to address or possible risk controversies that they have to try to quiet.
And are you mostly being paid for and working for firms, or is it occasionally an individual? Is it a government? Talk to me about the breadth of your clientele.
Many of my clients are corporations. Some are trade associations, but I'd say the corporate world is about half of my client base. The other half is largely government agencies, but also activist groups, sometimes but not too often media.
Okay, very good. And you are a risk person, but you're really a risk communication person, yes? Is that the most accurate way to describe your field?
That's exactly right. I do not have risk assessment expertise. I have at best a shit detector. After 30 years in the field, or now nearly 40 years in the field, I can read risk assessment and I can tell whether my client is giving me one-sided information or misinformation or not. But I'm not a risk assessor. I can't decide if something is dangerous. I'm an expert in how to talk about whether it's dangerous.
I see. And so talk to me for a minute about your cornerstone formula, and I'd like you to talk about it for the purposes of radio. I'd like you to name it. In other words, assume I don't know what it is, and just name it, describe it, say the words, and then, just describe. I'm interested in at least two things about it. One, how you came to it, including how long it took you to come to it. And two, what it means as a means to launch us into the broader conversation here.
Okay. The most important truth in risk communication is the exceedingly low correlation between whether a risk is dangerous and whether it's upsetting. That correlation hovers around 0.2. You can square a correlation to get the percentage of variance accounted for. You square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. That is, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely unrelated. If you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. Now, that low correlation is not my work, but back in the 1980s, looking at that low correlation and trying to make sense out of it, I coined the formula that sent my children to college and that has become sort of my signature formula. I said, all right, look, let's call whether a risk is dangerous or not, or how dangerous it is. Let's call that hazard. Let's call how upsetting it is outrage. And I coined the formula risk equals hazard plus outrage, which was my effort to claim that the risk really has two different components. The technical component is the hazard. The social component, the cultural component, is the outrage. And I argued, and now several decades later, still spent a lot of time arguing, that outrage isn't just a misperception of risk. It is a part of risk. It's a misperception of hazard, or at least it leads to a misperception of hazard. But outrage is really part of what people mean by risk. And if you're going to manage the risk, obviously you have to manage the hazard. I mean, you have a moral and legal obligation to manage the hazard. But managing the risk means managing the outrage also, getting people more upset if the hazard is high, getting people less upset if the hazard is low.
Mm. Now, when I look at the formula, which I love, risk equals hazard plus outrage, it makes perfect sense. It's almost a tautology after a while. That said, when I see the word risk there, I want to stick another word in front of it, which is perceived risk. That's really what you're talking about, right? Because the hazard in your formula is the actual risk, correct? And that the risk that you're trying to determine, hazard plus outrage, is really what people seem to think is the risk, that you can have a high hazard situation but low outrage, and the risk is low, whereas the actual risk may be high. Am I right on that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you definitions are stipulative. You can define things any way you like. And if you want to define the risk as purely technical, then what we're talking about is perceived risk. But that's not, in fact, what the public does.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to people and you explain to them that they're wrong about the hazard. Let's say people are terribly worried. Let's say we're at a public meeting, and people are terribly worried about the emissions from a factory that's in their neighborhood. They know that factory is emitting a chemical called dimethyl meatloaf, and they think the dimethyl meatloaf is giving their children cancer, and they're very, very upset.
To interrupt. You are saying dimethyl meatloaf, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah, yeah.
My hypothetical chemical.
Yeah. I don't remember that from chemistry class, but I'm happy. Okay.
Yeah. So people are very upset about the dimethyl meatloaf emissions.
Yep. Yep.
And let's assume you have terrific data that show that dimethyl meatloaf emissions are not, in fact, capable of causing the kind of cancer they have in their community. So that they are wrong about the hazard. Well, it's going to be hard to convince them that they're wrong about the hazard. But assume optimum conditions. Assume that you have good data, you're a good speaker, they're a rational audience, all relatively.
A lot of assumptions there, yep. Yeah.
But assume optimum conditions, and over a period of several hours, you succeed in convincing them that dimethyl meatloaf can't cause, leukemia, if leukemia is the kind of cancer they're worried about. So you've actually changed their hazard perception. Now, here's the point of this example. During the several hours during which you were, laboriously changing their hazard perception, it's very unlikely that their outrage has gone down. You're still the company that is emitting dimethyl meatloaf without getting their permission. You're still the company that has been arrogant, unresponsive, and less than honest about your dimethyl meatloaf emissions. You're still the factory that they wish wasn't in their neighborhood. All the sources of outrage are still there. And when you correct the hazard perception, the outrage doesn't go down. It may, in fact, go up. It's a little bit like Charlie Brown snatching away, having the football snatched away from him by Lucy. Their ammunition, their substantive ammunition, has gone away, but their outrage hasn't. So that they have, an additional source of outrage. The point is then that under those circumstances, if you ask people, now that you know that the dimethyl meatloaf isn't causing leukemia in your neighborhood, are you no longer upset about it? They'll tell you no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they'll start saying, well, maybe it causes some other kind of cancer, or maybe it causes birth defects, or maybe it, you know, maybe it causes asthma. They'll come up with new hypotheses that attach their outrage to a new hazard. So you don't accomplish anything in correcting people's hazard perception without managing their outrage.
Mm-hmm. So if your formula, which states that risk equals hazard plus outrage, I'd love it if you could give me a few examples of historical cases. You can go as far back or as recent as you want. What are a few instances where the outrage was very, very high, but the hazard was very low? First of all, let's start there.
Well, of course, you know, you have a bunch of them in your book. there are endless examples of both high hazard, low outrage risks and high outrage, low hazard risks.
When you think of the kind of quintessential high outrage, low hazard risks, I'm curious to know what comes to mind as the cornerstones.
Probably Superfund sites,
more
than any, you know, single example, which is not to say that all Superfund sites are low hazard. There are some that have been high hazard. But a large majority of Superfund sites, you know, if they are well managed, they became Superfund sites because the hazard might have been sizable. But once the site is being properly managed, the hazard goes way down.
Mm.
That's roughly the moment when the neighborhood finds out about the site and the outrage goes through the roof.
You did early work in your career on Three Mile Island, the accident there at the nuclear power plant. Where does nuclear power come into the risk equals hazard plus outrage spectrum?
Well, it's more complicated. Hazard is itself a product of two variables, the magnitude of the risk and the probability of the risk. Technical people measuring hazard are interested in two variables: how bad is it when it happens, and how often does it happen? The problem with nuclear power is the serious nuclear power accidents are extremely high magnitude and low probability. So they're sizable risks, but sizable hazards. But they're a weird kind of sizable hazard. They are infrequent but huge. And people have trouble with high magnitude, low probability risks. They either focus on the fact that it's high magnitude and overestimate its probability and think it's happening all the time, or they focus on its low probability and underestimate its high magnitude and imagine that, you know, even if it happened, we'd be okay.
And give me a favorite example of yours of the opposite case, where the hazard is high and the outrage is low.
Well, the classic examples of high hazard, low outrage risks are the ones that your doctor or your spouse give you a hard time about.
Mm-hmm.
It's smoking. It's drinking. It's eating too much, exercising too little, driving. Certainly driving without a seatbelt, driving while talking on your cell phone, but plain old driving. Those are all risks that have very high documented hazard, but it's hard to get upset about them.
So if I come to you, let's say I'm NHTSA, the part of the federal government that looks at traffic safety, or maybe a different federal agency that looks at medical behavior and risky behavior, and I come to you and say, yeah, Peter, here's our problem. You know the problem very well. People are smoking. People are driving inattentively, or they're driving drunk, or they're driving without seatbelts. And these are things that really do kill a lot of people, and they're not that concerned about it. So I need you to take this situation where the hazard is high, the outrage is low, and change the way people think about it. What do you do?
Well, there are lots of things you might do. Some of the most obvious and most important things are very boring things to do. Because the core problem with low outrage is apathy. I mean, apathy is a synonym for low outrage. Apathetic people are inattentive. It's hard to get their attention. It's even harder to hold their attention. So what you wind up doing in risk communication campaigns that are aimed at high hazard, low outrage risks, you wind up working very hard to make your message interesting because, you know, by definition, people find this issue boring. So you make it fun. You create slogans. You create jingles. Corporate safety people have long since learned that since safety meetings are extremely boring, they lard the safety meetings with jokes and riddles and songs and anything that'll keep people awake so that you buy some attention for your safety message. So making it interesting is important. Keeping it short is important. Repeating it often is important. Staying on message is important. I mean, you know, you've got a very small window of opportunity, so you figure out what the core messages are, what's likeliest to make a difference, and then you stick to it. Those are the obvious things. The part of what I call precaution advocacy, which is, you know, what you do with low outrage, high hazard risks. The part of precaution advocacy that's fun is the part that's more grounded in persuasion theory. That's aimed at arousing alarm in people who are disinclined to be alarmed through some of the subtler and more manipulative strategies of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
There's another point that I think is important to make here. Sometimes what looks like apathy about the risk, looks like insufficient outrage about the risk, is actually excessive outrage about the precaution.
Mm.
So if you're a company whose employees are not wearing their safety gear, you have to decide. Let's say you've got employees who are not wearing their hard hats. You have to decide if your problem is that they're not worried enough about their skull being crushed, or if they hate the hard hat a lot. Because it's itchy and it's uncomfortable and it looks geeky and whatever their reasons are, so if your problem is that they're not worried enough about having their skull crushed, then you're doing precaution advocacy about skull crushing. If your problem is that they're excessively outraged about the hard hat, then instead of trying to manage safety outrage up, you're trying to manage safety gear outrage down. And a lot of times when I look at a situation, and climate change is a stunning example of this, the problem gets misdiagnosed, and you're not actually mostly worried about you're not actually worried mostly about apathy at all. Your biggest problem is outrage about the precaution. People hate the precaution.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can just use the climate change example for a minute, I think,
please,
you want to talk more about climate change later in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But with climate change, early on, if we go back a decade, climate change risk communication was mostly precaution advocacy. It was people who weren't aware of the problem, who weren't taking the problem seriously, who needed to be awakened. Their apathy needed to be pierced. I don't think that's true anymore. I think there are obviously still plenty of people left on Earth who are unaware of climate change or apathetic about climate change. But I think there's a much more important growing audience of people who are outraged at the remedies that are proposed for climate change. They don't want to lose their SUV. They don't want to take the economic hit that they think the society will take if we take climate change mitigation to heart. If you're talking to a room full of people who hate the idea of the set of remedies you have proposed for climate change, and instead of trying to reduce their outrage about the remedies, you're busy trying to increase their outrage about climate change, you're fighting the wrong fight.
Mm-hmm. So let's stay on this subject for the rest of our conversation now on climate change, since you've obviously thought about a lot and written this pretty significant piece on it. So let's start by just applying your formula to this problem. So if risk equals hazard plus outrage, talk to me for a moment about how you overlay that formula onto the issue of climate change, and especially how, as you suggest, the measurement of each of those elements in your formula has shifted over the years.
Yes, well, you have two fundamental problems, and you have to decide which is the bigger of them, or when one is the bigger one and when the other one's the bigger one. One problem is apathy. People who are insufficiently upset about climate change. And the other problem is denial. People who are motivated not to be upset about climate change because they dislike something in the climate change message. They dislike the source of the message. They dislike, as I suggested earlier, the remedies that you're proposing. They don't like being blamed. They don't like how depressing and fatalistic your message is. There's something about what you're saying that is provoking denial. And apathy and denial look the same. And I have to stress, because denial is used in the climate change literature to mean something else entirely. I'm not talking about denial in the political sense. I'm talking about denial in the psychological sense, that people who can't bear to take climate change seriously because of something that they can't tolerate in the message. If that's what you're up against, then you need a set of strategies that are aimed at that. I don't have good data on this. I have very good data on what it takes to deal with denial and what it takes to deal with apathy and the difference between the two and the confusion that happens because denial looks like apathy. People in denial will tell you they're apathetic. They'll tell you, "I'm not interested in climate change."
Let me ask you to back up for one second. And, yes. The paper that you've written, Climate Change Risk Communication, The Problem of Psychological Denial. Just give me very briefly a background on that. Who'd you write the paper for and how did it come about?
I wrote it for my website. I have a website, which is not an effort to seek business. It's an effort to replace myself as I approach retirement by getting everything I know onto this site. And if you're allowed to say so, the website is www.psandman.com. As I say, it's not commercial. It's my effort to leave a legacy. And I pretty much anything I work on and think about, I eventually, get an opportunity or create an opportunity to write about for the website. So this article has been reprinted in other places, but certainly linked in other documents. But I wrote it for my website because I had been, working on and off for a decade or more with climates in the environmental movement. With clients in the environmental movement, and with government clients.
I see.
On the issue, and it seemed to me that again and again I was saying to clients, "You're misdiagnosing this issue."
So talk to me about some of the clients who've hired you to advise them on climate change.
Without naming them, I'll categorize them. I've worked several times with environmental groups that are deeply committed to advocacy for climate change mitigation. They want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and take other steps to reduce mitigate climate change. And they have come to me and said, "How do we talk about this? How do we sell this message?" The more interesting clients have been government agencies. I worked, for example, within the last couple of years for a government agency in Australia. One of the major, not federal agency, but one of the big Australian states, their environmental agency was very deeply committed to trying to reduce Australia's carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were talking to me about how do we talk about this issue, in all of the consultations I've done. On this issue, and I should add, just to complete the picture, my corporate clients not infrequently talk to me about climate change as well, and sometimes, it's how do we convince people that this is not a big deal, but not usually. I mean, most companies have come around that whether they secretly believe that or not, they know enough not to say so.
So in your paper, in the section called How We Provoke Denial, you write about a couple things that I think anybody will relate to. Fear-mongering, how scary is scary enough, and guilt-tripping, the stupid fight over whether global warming is anthropogenic. So when environmental groups come to you, are they typically engaging in a lot of fear-mongering and guilt-tripping, and you try to change the way that they communicate that? Or is it sometimes the other way around, where you tell them, hey, you need to increase the outrage here? How does that work?
It can be either. I've certainly had groups that were doing too, that I thought were doing too much fear-mongering, too much guilt-tripping, too much relying too much on ideology. One that you haven't mentioned that I think is super important is the fact that many environmental groups, are just delighted with the kinds of remedies that they think we need to mitigate global warming. That, they like the idea of consuming less. They like the idea of abandoning the internal combustion engine. They like the idea of eviscerating the oil industry and replacing fossil fuels with renewables. They liked all of that before they had ever heard of climate change. which isn't to say they're wrong about climate change. I think they're probably right about climate change, but they're delighted to be right.
Well, now, and
you can see the gloat, when they talk to you about we're going to have to abandon our SUVs. There's a little smirk there. And if they're talking to someone who loves his SUV or her SUV and hates the idea of abandoning it, is willing to if necessary, but we'll see that as a great loss. And the person trying to sell them, and whether we're talking about SUVs or more broadly, we're talking about a whole change in consumership and lifestyle. If somebody's going to sell me on something I hate, they need to hate it too. And if I get a sense that they are, that if climate change hadn't happened, they'd have had to invent it in order to get the changes they wanted anyway, that's going to really get in the way of my buying the message from them.
So what you're saying is probably doesn't really come as a surprise to people, but you come at it from a very interesting perspective, which is you're brought in to help firms, whether it's a corporation or an NGO or a government, communicate risk in a way that's productive for them. And you say that when you come in, you've got these a case where pre-existing personal biases or ideologies can kind of drive the steer the ship a little bit too much.
Exactly. I mean, as you pointed out earlier, it can be the other way. I mean, I have had clients that were still stuck in the mistaken conviction that data is persuasion.
And that
we're busy, giving, endless PowerPoint presentations that bored the apathetic audience instead of alerting them.
Yeah.
But the newer and bigger problem, as people have shifted from apathy to denial, the problem has shifted from too boring to too offensive.
Now, the paper that we that inspired this episode is a paper. I don't know if you – did you guys talk it through with him, Beret? Did you talk about this particular – the Dan Kahan paper a little bit? Okay. So the paper that inspired this was an empirical paper that looked at how scientific literacy and numeracy influences the way people think about climate change, the theory being that – ignorance is not the word you used early. What was the word you used? Apathy. No, there was a word besides apathy and ignorance you used, wasn't there?
Not sure what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Anyway, the theory being that if people are not aware of the extent of a problem or even a problem at all, that education is the path to enlightenment. And therefore, with a problem like climate change, whose risk is uncertain – but well worth considering, obviously, if people are more educated, that those people will become more proper stewards of the problem, let's say. And yet, this paper found something very interesting. It found that the more scientifically literate and the more numerate people were, the less they seemed concerned about the risks presented by climate change. Now, knowing what you know about the way people perceive risk in concert with the actual risk or the hazard combined with the outrage, does that finding surprise you?
Not really. I mean, one of the best known, facts in persuasion is that information is much more a result of attitude than it is a source of attitude. That is the model that underlies a lot of sort of information-based efforts to move people is a notion that, all right, you know, it's an educator's model. Information will change attitudes, and changing attitudes will change behavior. But way back in the 1950s, Leon Festinger invented his and studied his theory of cognitive dissonance. And what Festinger very persuasively showed is that people don't acquire much information unless they're seeking information. It's very hard to hammer information into people who are not looking for information.
And if they're seeking information, therefore, so you're interrupting what we would think is the normal course of events in an interesting way, but let me interrupt it even a little bit more. If they're seeking information, that tells you what about them?
Well, if they're seeking information, it tells you that they have some need which is impelling them to seek information. And, you know, you can create that need in order to motivate information seeking. And that's sort of where I was going with this.
Yeah, but in the case of climate change in particular, it sounds as though you're saying the people who seek out a lot of information about this particular topic, scientific information, political information, and so on, are those who have already got a pretty well-established set of interests in the topic to start with.
In either direction.
In either direction,
right. That's right. So what I would expect is, you know, people who become interested in climate change, either because they think it's really important and they want to fight for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, or they think it's really important because environmentalists are perpetrating a fraud and they want to fight against the environmentalist fraud and save our American way of life. Either way, those people are going to be much more interested in reading about climate change than someone who has neither of those viewpoints. Now, they're not going to read the same stuff.
Sure.
They're going to read stuff that confirms their preconceptions and therefore reduces their dissonance.
And the result being that even though people acquire information about the topic, that the acquisition of that information cascades into a furthering of ideological positions rather than a narrowing of them. Is that right?
That's correct. Information is a tool of confirming your preconceptions, and therefore information is sort of intrinsically polarizing. And the use of information to diminish polarization, to move people toward the middle, it's not impossible, but it's going against the grain. What information is good at is moving people toward the edge.
That is so interesting. Can you give me an example where it worked the way we would think that it would work and want it to work, whereas information moves people toward the middle, not toward the edge?
Let me think about that. It would usually be information that comes reluctantly from an unexpected source.
Maybe I wonder about the danger of smoking, let's say, is maybe something that over time has pushed people toward the middle.
Well, I'm not sure that the judgment that smoking is bad for you is the middle. It's just the other edge. I don't think information about smoking has pushed people toward the middle. It pushed them from one edge to slowly from one edge to the other edge. So we've gone from a society that grossly underestimates the risk of smoking to a society that at least statistically overestimates the risks of smoking. This is not your topic, but it's interesting that if you ask smokers to estimate the impact of smoking on their likelihood of dying, they overestimate, not underestimate that number. So they've gone to the other edge. But I think what's important here is, as an example of where information is useful, if I want to convince people who are uncomfortable with climate change that we need to take this seriously, that this is a real problem that calls for some pretty extreme solutions, I need to be someone who wishes that weren't so. And I think the environmental movement is a little bit, if you'll buy this analogy, it's a little bit like when George Bush decided that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. He wanted to invade Iraq. So his saying that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, it was awfully convenient. And he sounded awfully overconfident. He didn't say, look, it's through a glass darkly. Intelligence estimates are always uncertain, but this is too big a risk to take.
Mm.
Instead, he said, we're sure of it. I think the environmental movement is making the same mistake. Instead of saying, look, the harm of, if global warming is serious and we don't take it seriously, the harm will be huge and it's not a risk we can afford to take. That's a much more saleable message, and it's much more saleable if it comes from people who are visibly saddened, discomfited by the remedies that are necessary.
So when I hear you make this comparison, Peter, between, let's say, George Bush, what turned out to be overselling the threat of WMD, and environmental groups, what may be overselling the threat of climate change, I think a lot of people who hear anyone say that, if they're on the side who believes that climate change is a grave risk and that we need to be doing much more than we're doing, they're going to say, oh, this guy is something. I'm going to come up with a reason to think that you're a kook. That's right.
And that is exactly the point, isn't it?
Yeah, I say that
we reject information that threatens us, including rejecting the information that we reject information that threatens us. So it is an example of itself. Let me get this on the record. I am on the side of those who think climate change is serious. I'm not on their side because I've made an independent judgment that it's serious. I'm not qualified to study the data. I'm on their side for two reasons. The first reason is the history of science says that the establishment is usually right and the mavericks are usually wrong. The mavericks are right more often than the establishment pretends, but they're, but if you're going to bet and you don't have the data yourself, you're better off betting with the majority of scientists than with the minority of scientists. And the majority say global warming is serious, so I'm going to go with the majority. My other reason is because the cost of being wrong is not the same. The cost of taking it seriously and when it turns out to be, minor is substantial. But the cost of ignoring it when it turns out to be major is huge. So without being sure that the majority is right, I'm going to go with the majority, partly because they're the majority and partly because the cost of being wrong is lower if you take climate change seriously than if you shrug it off and turn out wrong in that direction. So I'm on their side. But I earn my living telling people I agree with that they're screwing up in how they're selling their message. And I think the people who are selling climate change are screwing up in at least half a dozen ways. One is, that I've emphasized a lot in this conversation is that they're visibly delighted with the remedies they're selling instead of saddened by them. We need a conservative climate change movement, and we're beginning to get one out of the insurance industry and out of some other corners of the society. We're beginning to get people who have reluctantly decided the environmentalists are right, and they're much more persuasive than the environmentalists are. So, that's part of it. We need a climate change advocacy movement that is less confident, that is talking. More the way insurance salespeople talk. Insurance salespeople don't say, your house is going to burn down. They say, your house might burn down, and if it does, that would be a disaster for you. And you buy insurance not because your house will burn down, but because it might. And when it doesn't burn down, you don't say that damn insurance salesman lied to me. You say, thank God my house didn't burn down, and you renew the policy. That's advocacy grounded in the magnitude of the risk, not the probability. And environmentalists are getting that wrong in the same way George Bush got that wrong. And they need to be saying, this is a chance we can't take, instead of saying, we're confident, we're certain, we know our models are good. Anybody who's been around for a while knows that modeling is a very uncertain science. So that's an error they're making. They're certainly focusing too much on guilt. It's very possible to say to people, There's no way you could have known. There's no way, you know, our whole society could have known, you know, when we built the society we've got, when we invented the wonderful conveniences we've invented. There's no way we could have known that we were digging ourselves a carbon trap. We didn't know that. We know it now, and we're beginning to figure out now how to dig our way out of that trap. But, you know, you can tell people we've been moving in the wrong direction and give them absolution and, you know, go out of your way to say it's not your fault. But the environmental movement likes guilt tripping. It likes blaming. So there's a lot of climate change advocacy that, you know, that says, you know, it's your fault, you evil, over-consumptive slob. You know, and that's not a good way to get me to change my ways.
Now, Peter, are you personally an evil, over-consumptive slob?
Well, we all are.
Say relative to the average American, then?
Relative to the average American, I'm probably, you know, a little better, but certainly not anywhere near as much better as environmentalists think I need to be.
What do you do that makes you a little bit better than average?
No, well, the normal things. I mean, my house is full of compact fluorescents, and there don't seem to be any incandescent bulbs left. And I try to drive less, and you know, when I
what kind of car do you drive?
I drive a very old it's a 19 I don't remember 82 maybe
a, oh my goodness
a very old car
yeah
and a small car
yeah.
I don't like cars. It's not, I mean, it, you know, I mean, it's like every time I imagine buying a new car, I think of all the things I could buy that I would enjoy more than a new car. And, you know, and my car is still running, and I, you know, so I drive it. It's become almost a reverse status symbol. But I'm not an environmental purist, but I, you know, because, you know, and this is cognitive dissonance too, because I work a lot with the environmental movement and I work a lot with environmental advocacy groups. I've absorbed a lot of their values. So I tend to think like them. Except in my field, I try not to think like them as a communicator because they're crappy communicators.
Give me just briefly, if this question resonates with you, or not you. If it resonates with you, please answer it. But if not, don't sweat it. But if I ask the people who know you best, would they say that by nature or by learning that you are more of an apocalyptic or a Pollyanna? If you had to choose one of the extremes.
They'd say I'm a Pollyanna.
You'd say that people are blowing all these risks out of proportion all over the place.
Well, I don't know if I'm a Pollyanna that way. You know, I think people who know me think that I see the best in other people, that I tend to be optimistic about the prospects for change.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be hypercritical of the strategies that are being used to achieve those changes, but I remain simultaneously despairing about the way people are going about the change and optimistic that they'll see the light and turn around.
Very good. So one last question. If I were to come to you as the, let's say, the head of the United States government, President Obama, and I say, you know, I care about climate change a lot, but for all kinds of reasons, social, political, economic, it's a very hard subject to gain the proper kind of traction on. And Peter, I think the first step is to change the way we communicate, change the way we have a climate change conversation. What do you do? What are your first few steps of action there?
All right. Here's a quick list. Number one, express regret for some of the solutions that are going to be unpleasant and costly. Number two, express uncertainty that you're right, but conviction that the risk is too great to ignore. Number three, give people absolution for having dug this ditch without realizing they were digging it. Number four, be interested in possible solutions that are less unpleasant. Take the possibility of a technical fix seriously. If we can't find one, then we can't find one. But environmentalists don't want to find one. They're very hostile to the idea that we might solve this problem without changing everything about our way of life. You know, be open to that. Number five, be more optimistic. Don't try to say the world is going to hell in a handbasket where it's already too late, we're doomed, therefore use compact fluorescence. Nobody's going to change their lives if we're doomed. We have to have a good shot at solving the problem seriously. Next to last point, take adaptation seriously. Instead of just trying to reduce our vulnerability or reduce the amount of climate change, try to reduce our vulnerability to climate change. Take seriously learning how to live comfortably in a hotter world with wilder weather. And finally, stop trashing the enemy. Be much more respectful of people who think you're wrong, or people who think the cost is too high, or people who are in any of a variety of ways opposed to the climate change movement. They're allowed to treat you with contempt. It's a big mistake to treat them with contempt.
So if these are the seven steps or platitudes toward communicating effectively the risk and actions needed to address climate change, express regret, uncertainty, offer absolution, consider other solutions, express optimism, consider adaptation, and don't trash the enemy. If those are the seven factors that, if they were executed properly, would, let's say, total a score of 100 on the Sandman scale of climate change communication, how would you assess the actual score on that scale of the broad mainstream climate change communication?
Well, this is where my optimism comes into play. I would put them at about a 30, but I think they've come up from about a 10. I think there is real movement in the directions that I'm prescribing, and I don't mean to imply that it's because of me. But I think lots of people are beginning to realize that accusing your audience and depressing your audience and guilt-tripping your audience and trashing your opponents is not a winning formula. And I although they have a long way to go, I think there is the beginning of a much more empirically sound communication approach on behalf of climate change.
Now, you say now that you would give climate change communicators a score of 30, let's say, out of 100 on an optimal scale, up, and you say that's up from where they were before, about 10. But earlier, I think you said, maybe this was in a pre-interview, and I think you've written elsewhere, that basically that they did do a pretty good job earlier. But was that more about communicating the actual issues as opposed to solutions? Can you clear that up for me?
Yeah, they did a good job and still do a good job when the audience is apathetic.
Right. But so they're good at informing to some degree.
They're good at informing. They're also good at arousing. But they're not good at addressing denial, and I think denial is a bigger and bigger piece of the problem, and that's the piece that they're screwing up big time. If you walk into a room full of people who never heard of climate change, or have heard of it but think it's boring, that calls for one set of messages. If you walk into a room full of people who have heard a lot about climate change and have come to the conclusion that it's a crock, that calls for a very different set of messages. We more and more are facing the second audience with messages that were designed for the first.
Ah, very good. Okay, what a great delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time and insights. This was really good.
My pleasure.
Okay, hope we cross again.
I hope so too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.